taken lightly and provoke fights and duels. Two antebellum planters might duel over who had a legitimate claim to a downed pigeon. Two gang members now might duel over a pair of sneakers. Now, too, in places like Oakland, Baltimore, and Chicago, stand men ready to risk death in order to humiliate and shame an opponent who has insulted them. And on the plantation, as in the inner city today, duels were public rituals. Greenberg calls them theatrical displays for public consumption, aimed at saving face and shaming others. One dueler stood triumphantly over his slain opponent and announced, "This is not the profile of a man, it is the profile of a dog." Duels required the presence of witnesses, and large numbers of people participated in duels as principals, seconds, adjudicators, physicians, timekeepers, or general audience. Enforced subordination. Another common practice of the slave owners that would be recognizable in our inner cities was informal polygamy. As overlords of their plantations, male planters took advantage of their position with young female slaves. "I hate slavery," fumed Mary Boykin Chestnut. "Under slavery, we live surrounded by prostitutes. God forgive us, but ours is a monstrous system, a wrong, and an iniquity. Like the patriarchs of old, our men live all in one house with their wives and their concubines, and the mulattoes one sees in every family partly resemble the white children. Any lady is ready to tell you who is the father of all the mulatto children in everybody's household but her own." One such patriarch was James Henry Hammond, Democratic senator from South Carolina, who was quite candid with his son Harry about his extracurricular activities. As Hammond wrote young Harry in 1856, "In the last will I made, I left to you Sally Johnson, the mother of Louisa, and all the children of both. Sally says Henderson is my child. It is possible, but I do not believe it. Yet act on hers rather than my opinion. Louisa's first child may be mine. I think not. Her second, I believe, is mine. Do not let Louisa or any of my children or possible children be the slaves of strangers. Slavery in the family will be their happiest earthly condition." Hammond drapes his sexual predation in the language of philanthropy. He speaks, some may say, as a true Democrat, and I agree. I see in Hammond a forerunner to Bill Clinton. Hammond displays the same sanctimony, the same quivering upper lip, even as his behavior reveals a ruthless selfishness. While Hammond is partial to slave women that he has bedded, and to slave children who might have resulted from those liaisons, he does not for a minute consider freeing any of them. Rather, he wants them to continue as slaves, although slaves in the family. Democrats in those days liked to affectionately refer to their slave households as "our family, black and white." A favorite discussion theme within the Democratic masterclass was the laziness and worthlessness of the slaves. It was a running joke among overseers that it takes two white men to make a black man work, and that it takes two to help one to do nothing. Even clear-eyed Mary Boykin Chestnut frets, "A hired man would be a good deal cheaper than a man whose father and mother, wife and 12 children have to be fed, clothed, housed and nursed, their taxes paid, and their doctor's bills, all for his half-done, slovenly, lazy work." Yet in reality, it was the slaves who did most of the work, and the planter class that was lazy and slovenly. The slaves were property, and therefore, it is true, they had little incentive to work. After all, they did not receive the fruits of their labor. With a straight face, the Democratic masterclass investigated the supposed maladies that led to slaves feigning illness or shirking work responsibilities. A Louisiana doctor active in the Democratic Party, Samuel Cartwright, diagnosed slaves as suffering from dysthasia aethiopica, a supposedly tropical ailment that caused malingering irresponsibility and rascality in slaves. Cartwright also identified drapetomania as the disease causing Negroes to run away. Recognizing that they would have to make the slaves work, masters introduced the whip as the main management solution of plantation society. The whip was sometimes used sparingly, but it was used nevertheless by severe and kind masters alike, and the whip left enduring scars, emotional no less than physical. During his slave days, Frederick Douglass was whipped so badly by the slave breaker, Edward Covey, that he says his mind broke down. The dark night of slavery closed in upon me, and behold, a man was transformed into a brute. Andrew Jackson, the founder of the Democratic Party, is sometimes compared to Thomas Jefferson. Both were admittedly Southern slave owners who owned around 200 slaves. Yet Jackson was in his early career a slave trader, a profession that was universally loathed by Jefferson and the whole founding generation, and looked down upon even in Jackson's own day. Yet Jackson's era was not Jefferson's, and Jackson truly represents the Democratic Party of his time in that he shows none of the qualms about slavery that are so characteristic of Jefferson. When one of his slaves ran away, Jackson purchased an ad in a local Tennessee newspaper offering a $50 reward for his capture and $10 extra for every 100 lashes a person will give to the amount of 300. 300 lashes may be considered something close to a death sentence. It is this barbarism in Jackson, unthinkable for Jefferson, that defines his era and, weirdly enough, coexists with democratic rhapsodies about how slavery is wonderful, not only for masters, but also for slaves. No system of tyranny can be sustained, however, entirely through force. The democratic master class recognized that it needed carrots as well as sticks. And beyond that, it needed a whole social system that would bind the slaves physically and emotionally to the plantation. So the master class created a slave system based on total dependency. The slaves, as Olmsted put it, were encouraged to develop a habit of perfect dependence, so that even without the whip, they could see no way out. This enforced subordination, according to the progressive black sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois, was the true meaning of slavery. But there was a real meaning to slavery different from that which we may apply to the laborer today, Du Bois wrote. It was in part psychological, the enforced personal feeling of inferiority, the calling of another master, the standing with hat in hand. It was the helplessness. It was the defenselessness of family life. It was the submergence below the arbitrary will of any sort of individual. For most of us now, such observations are telling because they give us a window into the past. Du Bois understood the psychology of the plantation. But for many Americans, especially poor blacks, Latinos, and Native Americans, what Du Bois writes will seem all too familiar. The past has not disappeared from the present. As we will see, there is a continuity between the Democrats of the mid-19th century and the Democrats now, and a system of enforced dependency is the precise way in which Democrats today maintain their ethnic plantations. Slaves without masters. The positive good school of slavery that emerged in the Democratic South is associated with such names as John C. Calhoun, James Henry Hammond, Henry Hughes, George Frederick Holmes, Thomas R. Dew, and Edmund Ruffin. Calhoun and Hammond led the charge in the Senate. All these men, needless to say, were Democrats. But its most notorious and charismatic spokesman was George Fitzhugh, author of Sociology for the South and Cannibals All, and a regular writer for pro-slavery publications such as the Richmond Inquirer and DeBow's Review. Fitzhugh was hardly a typical member of that school or even a typical Southerner. Unlike many who celebrated rural agrarianism, Fitzhugh wanted the South to become a manufacturing powerhouse like the North. Virtually alone among pro-slavery apologists, he kept up a lively correspondence with abolitionists. He seems to have convinced the labor reformer George Henry Evans, once a committed abolitionist, to switch allegiances and back the cause of the Confederacy. For all his uniqueness and eccentricity, Fitzhugh was also widely influential. We hear his arguments echoed by other pro-slavery writers. Lincoln, too, was familiar with Fitzhugh and found his arguments repulsive, but also interesting. The reason, as scholars like Eugene Genovese have recognized, is that Fitzhugh spelled out the logical outcome of the slave owner's philosophy and laid bare its essence. Fitzhugh was also a self-professed leftist and socialist, and progressive scholars, while seeking to keep their distance from him today, cannot resist praising this aspect of his thought. Writing as a Marxist, Genovese confessed his delight in Fitzhugh's attacks on free market capitalism. Many passages of Fitzhugh's work, writes Junius Rodriguez in Slavery in the United States, seem lifted directly from Marx, and others foreshadow 20th century leftist thought. Here, then, is Fitzhugh in a nutshell. He begins by noting that in every labor system, there are basically two kinds of labor, free labor and slave labor. Fitzhugh concedes that at the first glance, free labor seems preferable to slave labor because the farm or factory laborer can leave his employer and go work for someone else or not work at all. By contrast, slaves cannot quit, cannot work for themselves, and cannot refuse to work. But Fitzhugh is unimpressed by this distinction, which he regards as meaningless in practice. He goes on to make an outrageous point. Free labor is actually enslaved labor, and slave labor is actually free. Free labor, Fitzhugh says, is dog-eat-dog. The maxim, every man for himself, he writes, embraces the whole moral code of a free society. The harsh competition of capitalism, Fitzhugh says, benefits the few and the strong while crushing the many and the weak. As a consequence of freedom, the rich are continually growing richer and the poor poorer. Drawing on a term frequently used by Engels and subsequently used in Marxist theory, Fitzhugh terms laborers in a free market wage slaves. Of course, he's referring here to white slaves. They are slaves because they are no less dependent on their masters than legal slaves. They, too, must work in order to eat and to live. And yet, they have no protection, no provision, no security in the manner that legal slaves do. In a free market, Fitzhugh notes, the interest of masters is opposed to that of the wage slaves. When the slaves lose, the masters gain. The masters are always contriving to pay their workers less, playing them off against each other, even though the workers are the ones who produce all the products. Free society is a war of the rich with the poor, and the poor with one another. In such a society, Fitzhugh memorably observes, virtue loses all her loveliness because of her selfish aims. Fitzhugh takes note of northern travelers who unfavorably contrast the prosperity of the North with the backwardness of the South. Free labor, they argue, is more efficient and profitable than slave labor. Fitzhugh agrees but turns the argument against them, contending that precisely to the degree that capitalism is profitable, that is the measure of capitalist exploitation of the working class. Capitalists earn more, he says, by paying their workers less. They pay the worker only for time spent actually working, even though workers and their families also require support when the worker is disabled or old or sick. Capitalist entrepreneurs, Fitzhugh says, are basically slave masters without the obligations of a master. That's how they generate so much efficiency and profits. The beauty of slavery, according to Fitzhugh, is that it establishes an organic relationship between master and slave. Not a relationship of contract, but something more like a family. To those who say that slaves receive no compensation, Fitzhugh thunders that the considerable cost of maintaining a slave is the compensation. Moreover, the slave is provided for from cradle to grave. He is compensated, and his family is compensated, with food, shelter, and care, even when he is injured or sick or too old to work. In a manner that echoes Marx's famous doctrine, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, Fitzhugh contends that a farm or plantation is a sort of commune, in which the master furnishes the capital and skill and the slaves the labor and divide the profits not according to each one's input, but according to each one's wants and necessities. The problem with the socialist theory coming into vogue in Europe and the northeastern states, Fitzhugh writes, is that it is an ever-receding and illusory utopia. Socialists, he says, are attempting the impossible task of changing human nature. Slavery, he declares, is an actually existing form of socialism that happens to be its only workable form because it is based on human nature as it is. Slavery achieves the ends all communists and socialists desire. Fitzhugh concedes that there are masters who mistreat or abuse slaves, but even here, he writes, such abuse is qualified by the master's recognition that the slaves are expensive. Labor in slave society is property, he writes, and men will take care of their property. When slaves are worth near $1,000 a head, they will be carefully and well provided for. So paradoxically, the slave's status as chattel provides him a sort of protection. By contrast, Fitzhugh triumphantly notes, free laborers are not property, and this makes them disposable to their employers. If a capitalist entrepreneur has a dangerous job that may cost a worker his health or his life, Fitzhugh says, he won't risk having a slave do it. Rather, he would be sure to get an immigrant laborer who, if he falls and kills himself, does so at his own risk. Free laborers, Fitzhugh says, are basically slaves without masters, the worst possible situation for them to be in. Unlike other pro-slavery writers who wrote paeans to slavery but could not answer the objection, if slavery is so great, why not try it on white people? Fitzhugh argues that a national or even worldwide slave system would benefit all workers, white as well as black. In this respect, he was consistent, and he did not flinch when some of his fellow Democrats balked as he pursued the rationale of the pro-slavery philosophy to its logical conclusion. Ultimately, Fitzhugh says, the world will either adopt the slave system or the free labor system, and his own preference was clear. Yet in America, in his own day, Fitzhugh made the case to whites that they could escape being slaves because there were blacks to fill the task at hand. This racial hierarchy he attributes to the Democratic Party, of which he was a proud member. With blacks as the enslaved class, he says, white citizens, like those of Rome and Athens, are a privileged class. Here, from the mouth of a Democratic pro-slavery propagandist, are the roots of our contemporary term, white privilege. Fitzhugh also hints at what whites get out of white supremacy. They get the privilege of belonging to a superior caste, whether or not they own slaves. Even so, like his Democratic successors today, Fitzhugh would have hotly rejected the idea that he was anti-black. Negro slaves, he says, are the happiest and in some sense the freest people in the world. While the supposedly free white laborer of the North is constantly agonizing over how to support himself and his family, Fitzhugh says the black slave does his work and beyond that has not a care in the world because he and his family are fully provided for in any possible situation. Slavery, Fitzhugh argues, is especially suited for blacks because the Negro is but a grown-up child. His liberty is a curse to himself and a greater curse to the society around him. The master occupies toward him the place of parent or guardian. So convinced is Fitzhugh about the benefits of blacks in captivity that in a pamphlet, What Shall Be Done with the Free Negroes, he recommends that they should recognize what's good for them and voluntarily enslave themselves. Let them select their masters. Fitzhugh insists that the slave community is a kind of extended family in which the interests of the various members of the family circle concur and harmonize. His rhetoric on this point seems akin to and reminiscent of Democratic Governor Mario Cuomo's 1984 Democratic Convention speech in which he likened the whole nation to a single family working toward a common purpose, one that takes care of all its members. It seems almost eerie to hear Fitzhugh speak the modern language of compassion and social justice. For him, slavery is the ultimate expression of both. Without slavery, Fitzhugh warns, blacks would be an intolerable burden to themselves and society. As slaves, they are provided for in a manner that may seem meager, but is in fact better than they could provide for themselves. For Fitzhugh, the slave plantation is a sort of welfare state, offering at least a basic provision of food, health care, and security for all of its inhabitants. Fitzhugh's sharp break with the American founders can be seen in his ridicule of Thomas Jefferson. In this, he is not alone. Calhoun, Hammond, and Jefferson Davis all attack the equality clause of the Declaration of Independence, proclaiming it not self-evidently true, but self-evidently false. Here again, we see what Lincoln means when he says that the Democrats introduced a new spirit of receptivity to tyranny that was not present at the founding. In response to the Declaration of Independence, Fitzhugh quips that blacks have a natural and inalienable right to be slaves, seeking to refute Jefferson's famous remark that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their back, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God. Fitzhugh responds that some people are meant to be ridden, and the riding does them good. They need the reins, the bit, and the spur. Fitzhugh pungently attacks not merely Adam Smith's free market philosophy, a system of unmitigated selfishness, rotten to the core, but also John Locke's theory of the social contract, which posits that humans have natural rights and societies are formed with limited power to enforce only those rights that are delegated to the state. Nonsense, says Fitzhugh. Man is born a member of society. He has no rights whatsoever, as opposed to the interests of society. Whatever rights he has are subordinate to the good of the whole. Here, as we will see, Fitzhugh proves a forerunner to the fascist glorification of the state, an ideology that would strongly influence Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Democratic Party in the 20th century. As you may have begun to suspect by this point, George Fitzhugh was a statist and a supporter of a strong and powerful government, which in his time admittedly involved state power, not federal power. In this, Fitzhugh was not alone. Most of the members of the Democrats' positive good school were statists. Henry Hughes, for example, condemned abolitionist agitation as a rebellion against the state. Once again, however, Fitzhugh spells out the position with the greatest clarity. While some people say the world is too little governed, Fitzhugh insists that the masses require protection and control. He adds, more of government is needed. Government is the life of a nation, and it is absurd to define on paper what they shall do and not do. For him, government power is unlimited, and its exercise is controlled only by the exigencies of a given situation. Fitzhugh places his hope for realizing his vision, at least in the United States, in the Democratic Party, a political commitment to the common interests of master and slave on the plantation is the true and honorable distinction of the Democratic Party. Thrilled that the Democrats are dominant in the South, he predicts that soon the Democratic Party will be in the majority again at the North. The outlook and mores of the Democratic plantation, he feels, would surely become universal. Give the North a little more time and she will eagerly adopt them. Here, of course, Fitzhugh proved to be wrong. Despite resolute attempts by the Northern Democrats to sell the plantation, the Northern states did not adopt the plantation way of seeing things. Rather, they adopted the way of a new and, from Fitzhugh's perspective, most dangerous party, the Republicans, under a man Fitzhugh found surpassingly strange, Abraham Lincoln. Yet Lincoln agreed with Fitzhugh that the House would not stay permanently divided. Either his way or Fitzhugh's way, the free system or the slave system, would eventually prevail. Fitzhugh's run was, of course, ended by the Civil War. His home in Port Royal, Virginia, was leveled by Union troops, and he fled to Richmond. After the war, he was employed, strangely enough, by the Freedmen's Bureau. Refusing to retract his theories, Fitzhugh, as a judge of the Freedmen's Court, lectured emancipated blacks about how they were better off under slavery. In 1857, he even told a group of snickering abolitionists, "Is our house tumbling about our heads? No, no. Our edifice is one that never did fail, and never will fail." In a sense, he was right. Certainly the plantation that Fitzhugh knew and loved, populated with what he took to be happy, contented slaves, was no more. but Fitzhugh's paternalistic philosophy of the plantation as a kind of infant welfare state did not completely die with it. Fitzhugh's arguments, we cannot expect people to compete in the market, self-reliance is a chimera, people are happiest when they are looked after in the big house, have a startling contemporary relevance. In fact, we see recognizable elements of his thinking among our own progressive Democrats, confirming my point that the pro-slavery Democrats of the South, for all their distance in time, are not so distant in ideology from the Democrats of today. Lincoln's refutation. Before I get to Lincoln's refutation of these pro-slavery schools of thought, it's important to emphasize that Lincoln was not merely refuting Southerners. He was refuting Democrats. Lincoln was not a hater of the South. "I have no prejudice against the Southern people," he said in his first debate with Stephen Douglas at Ottawa in 1858. "They are just what we would be in their situation. If slavery did not now exist among them, they would not introduce it. If it did now exist among us, we should not instantly give it up. If Southerners were reluctant to abolish slavery at one stroke," Lincoln said, "I surely will not blame them for not doing what I should not know how to do myself." Yet Lincoln showed no comparable gentleness in taking on the Democratic apologias for slavery, whether coming from the North or the South. "Whenever I hear anyone arguing for slavery, I feel a strong impulse to see it tried on him personally." That's what Lincoln told the 140th Indiana Regiment toward the end of the Civil War. It echoed what Lincoln had said earlier. "Slavery is good for some people," he wrote in an undated fragment around 1858, mimicking the Democratic positive good argument. Then he commented on it. "As a good thing, slavery is strikingly peculiar in this, that it is the only good thing which no man ever seeks the good of for himself." Here Lincoln's charge of hypocrisy is evident. And he deepened the charge with what followed. Nonsense. Wolves devouring lambs, not because it is good for their own greedy maws, but because it is good for the lambs. Here, with deadly accuracy, Lincoln struck at the Democratic pose of taking advantage of the slave while pretending to be his best friend. Yet while Lincoln was sarcastically dismissive of the Southern Democrats, he took a more serious, though ultimately not less indignant, stance against the Northern Democrats, led by Stephen Douglas. Douglas was a follower of Andrew Jackson. A fiery, diminutive man, Douglas was called the Little Giant because of his formidable intellect and debating prowess. Lincoln regarded him as his supreme antagonist. On slavery, Douglas took what may be called the pro-choice position. Like Taney, he insisted he was not, in his personal views, pro-slavery. But neither, he acknowledged, was he anti-slavery. Rather, his was a stance of public indifference. "It is none of my business which way the slavery clause is decided. I care not whether it is voted down or voted up." This was something for each particular state or community to decide for itself. The issue for him was not one of principle. The issue was one of free choice. Douglas noted that we live in a big country. Naturally, people will have differing views on a subject as contentious as slavery. In some places, slavery seems to make sense, in others it doesn't. In Illinois, Douglas said, "We tried slavery, kept it up for 12 years, and finding that it was not profitable, we abolished it for that reason, and became a free state." Illinois' approach illustrated Douglas's national model. Let's agree to disagree. Diversity, he said, is the great safeguard of our liberties. Why impose a uniform position, whether it be pro-slavery or anti-slavery, on the whole country? This was a recipe for confrontation and strife. To prevent that, Douglas took a stance that he regarded as disinterested and statesmanlike. Essentially, his stance was not to take a position, but to step aside and let each community or territory or state make its own decision and live with it. What, Douglas asked, could be a more democratic remedy than that? Douglas called his stance popular sovereignty. In a famous article in Harper's, Douglas affirmed, the right of every distinct political community to make their own local laws, form their own domestic institutions, and manage their own internal affairs in their own way. Applying popular sovereignty to Kansas, he said, if the people of Kansas want a slaveholding state, let them have it. And if they want a free state, they have a right to it. And this approach, Douglas insisted, was congruent with the intentions of the founders. Douglas may have been indifferent regarding slavery, but he was not indifferent regarding blacks. In one of his debates with Lincoln, Douglas said, I do not question Mr. Lincoln's conscientious belief that the Negro was made his equal, and hence his brother. But for my own part, I do not regard the Negro as my equal, and positively deny that he is my brother or any kin to me whatever. As I mentioned earlier in this chapter, Douglas was a white supremacist. So were virtually all Democrats in the antebellum era. From Douglas's abstemious rhetoric, it might seem that his position on slavery was quite modest, seeking for it a limited reach and legitimacy. But in fact, Douglas envisioned a massive slave empire south of the Mason-Dixon line, one that stretched from the Atlantic to the Pacific and incorporated Mexico, Central America, and the islands of the Caribbean. Expansion was the keynote of Douglas's foreign policy, Harry Jaffa writes. Popular sovereignty of his domestic policy. Let us now zoom in on Douglas's reasoning about slavery. If we pay attention to it, we can see how close Douglas's position is to the progressive Democratic stance today on abortion. Obviously, Douglas referred to a choice made by communities, not individuals, but that is the sole difference. Otherwise, the reasoning is the same. Who is to say when life begins? Let's agree to disagree. The right to choose is paramount. This pro-choice logic was directly challenged by Lincoln. First, Lincoln showed the radicalism behind Douglas's supposedly modest stance. He pointed out that not only did Douglas seek to create a transcontinental slave empire, but he has no desire that there shall ever be an end of it. Douglas emphatically rejected the founders' wish that slavery be placed on a path to ultimate extinction. If Douglas had his way, states and communities in America now would be deciding for themselves whether or not to enslave blacks. Lincoln also exposed the inner contradiction in Douglas's position, and in doing so, this also supplies us today with the most powerful refutation of so-called pro-choice logic. Lincoln argued that for individuals no less than communities, choice is, in general, the correct approach. No one would dream, Lincoln said, of interfering with the cranberry laws of Indiana or the oyster laws of Virginia. But slavery laws, Lincoln emphasized, are not in the same category. In other words, choice is not an absolute principle. Choice, Lincoln suggested in response to Douglas, can never be unequivocally affirmed without regard to the content of the choice. Lincoln's argument applies equally to slavery and abortion. Let us consider what is being chosen. In these cases, we are talking about enslaving other people, forcibly taking away their lives and liberties, or in the abortion case, killing them in the womb. In both instances, choice is invoked in order to cancel out the choices of others. In both cases, self-government is a pretext for the denial of self-government. In both cases, persons who have the same rights as everyone else are being sacrificed to the convenience and welfare of others. The problem with Douglas, as Lincoln put it, is that he has no very vivid impression that the Negro is a human. Lincoln took Douglas to be arguing that, inasmuch as you do not object to my taking my hog to Nebraska, therefore I must not object to you taking your slave. Now, I admit this is perfectly logical if there is no difference between hogs and Negroes. Lincoln summarized Douglas's position this way, if one man choose to enslave another, no third man shall have the right to object. In the end, Lincoln regarded the position of Douglas and the Northern Democrats to be no less pro-slavery than that of the Southern Democrats. It would do as much to nationalize slavery as the doctrine of Jeff Davis himself. In some ways, Douglass's view was more dangerous than that of Davis, Fitzhugh, or Calhoun, because Douglass's professed neutrality could seduce well-meaning people into believing that popular sovereignty was the solution for slavery. Yet Lincoln saw that popular sovereignty was merely a cover for the protection and even extension of slavery, in a manner that echoes contemporary pro-lifers who contend that pro-choice really means pro-abortion. Lincoln contends that pro-choice really means pro-slavery. Of Douglass's popular sovereignty, he said, "This declared indifference, but as I must think, covert real zeal for the spread of slavery, I cannot but hate. In the end," he warned, "it will blow out the moral lights around us. Here in the muck and meanness of slavery lie the roots of the Democratic Party. The plantation was its original stomping ground. The Democrats fought tenaciously for the plantation, and when they were defeated, they fought just as tenaciously for the revival of the plantation. But the first step for the party, taken even before the Civil War, was to figure out how to apply the plantation model to the North, where immigrants by the millions and ultimately tens of millions were pouring into this country. The party of enslavement had big plans for them." Chapter 4. Urban Plantation. Martin Van Buren and the creation of the Northern political machine. Everybody is talking these days about Tammany men growing rich on graft, but nobody thinks of drawing the distinction between honest graft and dishonest graft. George Washington Plunkett, Plunkett of Tammany Hall. To hear the Democrats tell it, their love of the Mexican people has simply grown and grown and grown. This is now reflected in the unabashed loyalty that leading Democrats and the Democratic Party platform show toward illegal aliens. In the past, Democrats at least paid lip service to the necessity for immigration laws to be enforced and for all people to obey the law. No more. The Democratic platform of 2016 didn't even use the term illegal or any variation of it. It described America's immigration system as a problem, but not illegal immigration. A decade or two ago, remarked Jason Furman, chairman of Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, Democrats were divided on immigration. Now everyone agrees and is passionate and thinks very little about any potential downsides. The Democrats as a party are on the side of the illegals. Under the Obama administration, illegals became a sort of privileged law-breaking class. Initially, Obama did not hesitate to deport illegals, essentially carrying out the law and continuing the policies of the preceding Bush administration. Then Obama changed course and publicly announced that through an exercise of prosecutorial discretion, immigration laws would only be enforced against certain types of illegals, namely violent criminals, while ordinary run-of-the-mill illegals would be left alone. Now, under Trump, Democrats in blue states are fighting hard to protect illegals from being sent back to their home countries. We all know about the sanctuary cities that now dot blue states across the country. Mayors of these cities have made it clear that they have no intention of cooperating in the enforcement of immigration laws. On the contrary, they will give sanctuary to lawbreakers who seek to evade those laws. Progressives in California and New York go even further. California Democrats recently passed a law forbidding law enforcement from asking anyone's immigrant status or holding them for Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, unless they have been convicted of a crime. California also passed a law making it a crime for landlords to report illegals to the federal government. And recently, the mayor of Oakland, Libby Schaaf, generated controversy for tipping off illegal immigrant groups that they were going to be raided by ICE authorities. In New York, even a criminal conviction is not enough to deny illegals the protection of the state. New York's Democratic governor, Andrew Cuomo, recently pardoned 18 alien criminals, no murderers, mostly thieves and drug dealers, for the express purpose of saving them from potential deportation back to Mexico. These actions, Cuomo said, take a critical step toward a more just, more fair, and more compassionate New York. What idealism, what moral fervor. Ah, yes, I can envision Cuomo, himself descended from Italian immigrants, staring wistfully at the Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island as he signed those pardons. He was probably remembering his parents and grandparents who still spoke with Italian accents, or his original ancestors not many generations removed, who came to this country speaking no English at all. Democrats, Cuomo believes, are the party of the new immigrants, just as they were the party of the old immigrants, the Irish, the Italians, the Jews. Trump, Cuomo alleges, continues to target immigrants and threatens to tear families apart. Democrats are quick to tar immigration enforcement policies with the brush of racism and white supremacy. Part of the strategy is to disguise the fact that illegals are lawbreakers. The New York Times headline reads, in rebuke to Trump, Cuomo pardons 18 immigrants. But illegal aliens are not immigrants. An immigrant is someone who has emigrated legally to this country through a sanctioned immigration process. The point of conflating illegals and immigrants, however, is to pretend that in resisting illegal immigration, Trump and the Republicans are against immigrants themselves. So the media is complicit with the Democrats in making the case that progressives are the partisans of the poor, wretched masses that have poured into this country for nearly two centuries and have inevitably faced intolerance, bigotry, and exclusion. Look, say the Democrats, with media outlets like the New York Times cheering wildly in the background, the Latinos are voting for us over the Republicans, 2-1. And this by itself proves that we are their friends and protectors. Yet imagine if the Latinos voted 2-1 for the Republican Party. Imagine if illegals, upon securing citizenship, started wearing Make America Great Again hats. How enthusiastic would Democrats be about fighting for illegal aliens and giving them a path to citizenship? It seems safe to say, not very. Progressive affinity for illegals seems contingent upon a kind of implicit bargain, one in which Democrats secure benefits for illegals and in exchange, illegals agree to become Democrats. Remove this condition and Democratic support for illegals evaporates. My wife Debbie, a native of Venezuela, is sympathetic to the plight of so-called DACA children of illegals who have grown up in this country. She cannot see sending them all back to their parents' nations. Many of them, she points out, don't even speak Spanish. They could not survive there. So why not, she suggests, give them a way to live and work legally in this country. Give them all rights except one, the right to vote. This is not unfair because they are, after all, lawbreakers. As a convicted felon, I can't vote either. In the Rio Grande Valley of South Texas, where Debbie grew up, virtually everyone is a Democrat. Yet not a single Democratic official to whom Debbie has mentioned this idea has expressed any interest in pushing forward with it. Very telling. In 2010, speaking to a group of Hispanics, Obama emphasized Democratic fealty to Latinos as a group and invoked border security and strict immigration enforcement as proof that Republicans aren't the kind of folks who represent our core values. Obama warned that if Hispanics stayed home on Election Day, Republicans would be elected, and then I think it's going to be harder. He urged Hispanics to coalesce as a group and say to themselves, we're going to punish our enemies and we're going to reward our friends. While he later denied it, recasting his argument in the anodyne language of Democrats fighting for the little guy, Obama knew he was appealing to ethnic resentment as a form of political motivation. This is a core part of Democratic political strategy in the 21st century. The rest is largely humbug to camouflage this fact. So progressive enthusiasm for the masses clamoring to get into this country seems rather more self-interested than progressives are generally willing to admit. Some of them, however, do admit it. As progressive political scientist Adam Bonica told the New York Times, the immigration issue offers a strategic advantage for the Democrats. What he means is that the politics of ethnic mobilization work as long as the ethnics keep their end of the bargain. Democrats are happy to bring more Latino illegals here as long as Latinos deliver the vote for Democrats. Politics is a two-way street, and as long as the Latinos appreciate this, there is a place reserved for them on the Democratic urban plantation. A novel theft scheme. This chapter is about the formation of the Democrats' urban plantation, otherwise known as the urban political machine. Of course, there were some Republican machines, too, in cities like Philadelphia in the second half of the 19th century. But the urban machine was a creation of Northern Democrats in the Jacksonian era, and it reflected Democratic power in the cities of the North. So far, to my knowledge, no one has examined the relationship between the rural and the urban plantations, even though this was the basis for the unification of the Democratic Party and for its political domination from the 1820s through the Civil War. The urban plantation was characterized by the fact that it produced nothing. In this respect, it was very different from the rural slave plantations, which produced cotton, sugarcane, rice, tobacco, and so on. Rural slave plantations were designed to be productive. Urban plantations were not. They were both designed as mechanisms for stealing. In this respect, one may say that the urban plantation had the same basic purpose as its rural counterpart. Both were systems of larceny on a grand scale. Yet the thefts in the two cases were different. On the rural slave plantation, the theft was fairly straightforward. One man, let's call him A, steals from another man, B, by making him a slave. A is white and B is black, and the product stolen is B's labor. A benefits by appropriating the fruits of B's work and making them his own. In this case, the larceny is effectuated by force. A purchases B and reduces him to a possession, holds him in captivity, and makes him work through whips and intimidation, providing him with just enough to keep him healthy and useful to A's bottom line. In the urban plantation, the theft is more sophisticated, although in the end, no less profitable. It's worth noting that on the rural plantation, A can become wealthy through stolen labor, but for this to happen, he must have lots of bees. A single bee won't suffice because B is a poor man, and he has nothing that can be taken from him except his labor. The thieves on the urban plantation, however, have a much bigger prey. Here they steal from a much larger group, one made up of the entire body of productive citizens. The target of the urban plantation is taxpayers of all income levels, and also corporations, anyone who contributes to the public treasury. Here a thief, A, makes a deal with B, or actually many Bs. B is a poor, recently arrived immigrant, typically Irish, German, Scandinavian, Italian, or Jewish. These Bs are recruited into a theft scheme, but they have no idea how it operates. They are merely poor fellows trying to survive in a new country. A promises B, these nameless immigrants whom we'll collectively call B, some meager favors, a job reference, a place to stay for a few days, a turkey dinner, or a flask of whiskey, in exchange for something that doesn't cost B anything, his vote. There's no compulsion here except that of necessity. B is in dire straits, and he agrees to the deal. He might have agreed to do it for even less. A then uses B's votes to accumulate sufficient political power to get his hands on the public treasury. This for A is Fort Knox, and the immigrant vote has now supplied him with the key. Since no one is minding Fort Knox, the taxpayers who have paid into the system have no idea what is being done with their money, A is in a position to loot the treasury. So A uses B's vote to steal from another man, let's call him C. Then he uses the proceeds to pay for the pittance he provides to B, ensuring not merely his election, but now his re-election. Does all of this sound familiar? It should. It is, at least in rough outline, the modus operandi of the contemporary Democratic Party. Yet all of this started in the mid-19th century through the model of the urban plantation, the urban political machine, which was also an ethnic machine. Yet the full scoop on the formation of the urban ethnic machine is an untold story in American politics. We do have, of course, the progressive version of the tale, and we should note that this version has itself undergone a change in recent years. For most of the 20th century, progressive historians portrayed urban ethnic plantations like New York's Tammany Hall as hotbeds of corruption, bravely challenged by progressives and eventually dispatched by progressive icon Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s. Of late, however, Tammany and the machines are getting a much better press. Here's a recent headline in the New York Times. The Forgotten Virtues of Tammany Hall. The author, Terry Golway, concedes that Tammany became the very face of political corruption. The bosses stole elections, intimidated political antagonists, and shook down contractors and vendors. But even so, he insists, elaborating his argument in his book, Machine Made, Tammany illustrated how the Democrats extended the hand of friendship to new immigrants. In an interview on NPR, Golway credited the Democratic bosses with creating, in essence, an informal welfare system when, of course, none existed. In this respect, Tammany foreshadowed and ultimately enabled the reform politics of the New Deal and the modern Democratic Party. The urban ethnic machine, historian Ted Widmer writes, allowed democracy to grow beyond the founding documents into something tangible for millions of disenfranchised Americans. The ethnic machines were an elaborate mechanism to put the theoretical ideals of the founding into everyday working practice. In Widmer's progressive portrait, the ethnic machines gave a voice to new immigrants who didn't have anyone to speak for them until the Democratic Party came to their rescue. There is more, much more in this vein. In 2016, Kevin Baker published a remarkable essay in the New Republic arguing that ethnic political machines were corrupt to the core, but they were also incredibly effective. If Democrats want to survive in the modern age, they need to take a page from their past. In other words, bring back the old ethnic machine. That won't happen. The old ethnic machines were too obviously corrupt, and progressives gained a lot of political traction in railing against this corruption and portraying their man, FDR, as the great reformer. But what the progressives don't say is that Democrats legalized this corruption and made it part of their customary way of doing politics. Today, the Democrats are once again active in the politics of ethnic mobilization, and the reason progressives are soft on the ethnic rackets of the past is that they know that they are still running those rackets today. In this respect, Tammany is still with us in modified form. But where did Tammany come from? What was the origin of the machines themselves? Here's a clue that reveals the nexus. The ethnic machine produced what historians now term pork barrel politics. The pork barrel is the treasury, and pork barrel politics refers to the familiar practice of politicians conspiring with each other and ripping off the treasury to fund largely useless projects that buy votes. This term, however, can be traced directly to the old plantation. In Chester Collins Maxey's 1919 article in National Municipal Review, A Little History of Pork, we find this revealing tidbit. On the southern plantation in slavery days, there was a custom of periodically distributing rations of salt pork among the slaves. As the pork was usually packed in salt barrels, the method of distribution was to knock the head out of the barrel and require each slave to come to the barrel and receive his portion. Oftentimes, the eagerness of the slaves would result in a rush upon the pork barrel to grab as much as possible for himself. So the rural and urban plantations were connected closely enough that the customs of the former could be drawn upon to describe the practices of the latter. Both operated on a principle that has defined the Democratic Party since its founding, the principle of dependency. While the slave plantation was based on the dependency of helpless black slaves, the urban plantation was based upon the dependency of helpless white immigrants. Both became fodder for the exploitative machinations of the Democratic Party. The man who figured this out was Martin Van Buren. The Little Magician. Van Buren has proven to be an enigma, both in his own time and in ours. Today, the enigma may be partly due to the man's contemporary obscurity. If we remember what he looks like, his distinguishing feature is his absurdly large sideburns. Some will recall his unsuccessful presidency from 1836 to 1840, when he was defeated for re-election by William Henry Harrison. Van Buren played a bit role as a villain in Steven Spielberg's film Amistad, in which he was accurately shown as spurning the Africans' plea for freedom. His obscurity was the butt of a running joke on Seinfeld about a secret group that called itself the Van Buren Boys. In his own time, however, Van Buren was a colossus. This seems like an odd term to use for a short guy like Van Buren, barely 5 feet 6 inches tall, whom his contemporaries nicknamed Little Van. Yet there was no diminishing the importance of the dapper New Yorker who had risen from the obscure origins of a tavern keeper's son to become the most powerful politician in the state. In the country, his influence was second only to Andrew Jackson's. And by all accounts, Van Buren made Jackson, securing his election in 1828 and assuring his re-election in 1832. In the process, here contemporary and modern accounts agree, Van Buren virtually single-handedly created the urban political machine. And he also created the winning alliance that not only propelled Jackson and then Van Buren himself to the presidency, but also sustained the Democratic Party as the majority party for 40 years. Incredibly, Van Buren did all this before he became president. His was a life in which his unsuccessful presidency was merely an appendage and footnote to an amazingly successful career. Yet his contemporaries, friend and foe alike, also considered Van Buren to be a mystery. Biographer Ted Widmer writes of Van Buren's peers, confessing that no one knows exactly what he is up to, and then adds that he himself cannot trace 1,000 cat steps that brought him invisibly to his destination. Biographer Robert Remini lists several of the names his peers used to describe him: Little Magician, Red Fox of Kinderhook, The Enchanter, and Master Spirit. Remini cites the example of Davy Crockett, the fiery, whimsical frontiersman who was no fan of Van Buren. Crockett dismissed Van Buren as an artful, cunning, selfish, speculating lawyer who can lay no claim to preeminent service as a statesman, nor has he ever given any evidences of superior talent. Asked to account for his success, however, Crockett could do no better than to term Van Buren a riddle that must puzzle the devil. Modern scholars like Remini and Widmer, two progressive biographers of Van Buren, portray the man in glowing colors, a very different portrait than Crockett's. Yet they too profess to be mystified by him. Widmer confesses that Van Buren eludes us today and has been escaping pursuers since they began chasing him. While admitting that Van Buren's creation of the Democratic Party was the achievement of a lifetime, Widmer nevertheless adds, even with all the hindsight that history can confer, it is unclear how exactly Van Buren wrought this great change. Widmer attributes the mysteriousness of Van Buren in part to the fact that he apparently destroyed those parts of his correspondence that would have revealed his innermost secrets. Moreover, in his own life, Van Buren was famously evasive. He was known never to commit himself fully to a position. Acting on a bet that he could force Van Buren to take a stance, a senator once asked him if it was true that the sun rose in the east. Van Buren dryly replied, "I sleep until after sunrise." The puzzle is not over what Van Buren did, it is over how he did it. The normal way to tell the story is chronologically: first, an account of how Van Buren built up his New York machine, and then a subsequent account of how he used it to create the party organization that propelled Jackson to power as the first president from the Democratic Party. I believe, however, that we can understand Van Buren better by considering his life in reverse. First, how he created a new political party under Jackson, a legacy that lasted 40 years, and then how he laid the foundation for ethnic machine politics, a legacy that is with us to this day. Our story then breaks with narrative history and gives us Van Buren's two feats in ascending order of importance. We begin around 1821 with Van Buren as the newly elected senator from New York and the undisputed leader of the New York Democratic machine, known as the Albany Regency. Let's pick up the progressive narrative from biographers like Remini and Widmer. I have no dispute with the basic details of this narrative, which goes like this. Van Buren recognized that any majority coalition in America would have to politically unite the North and the South. A New York-Virginia alliance, assembled during the founding era, had elected in turn Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe. In that era, however, Virginia was top dog and New York had second place. Van Buren's New York, however, had grown prodigiously in population and wealth by the second decade of the 19th century. So Van Buren's idea was to create a new political party based on reuniting North and South, New York and Virginia. Only this time, New York would play the leading role, and Virginia would be invited to go along.